Education and Healthcare Reporting on SDPB is supported by Regional Health, helping patients and communities live well.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in today for Lori Walsh. Computers can play chess and drive cars, but can they diagnose pneumonia or read a mammogram? More on that coming up, but first, at the end of our spring member drive, it's time for us to announce some big winners thanks to your generous donations to South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And Rachel Nelson of Rapid City is the winner of our drawing for a new iPad. So Rachel Nelson of Rapid City, you'll be hearing from us soon, and congratulations and thanks for your gift. And speaking of technology, Richard Harris is a correspondent for the Science Desk at NPR. He's begun an ongoing series examining the rise of artificial intelligence in the field of healthcare. The first two installments of his series aired on April 1st. I spoke with Harris last week about how the field is developing so far, how patients are responding, and what the immediate future might hold for AI in medicine. This topic is really broad, the idea of artificial intelligence in healthcare, and I'm curious about what was the impetus for you starting on this series?
Well, there's obviously been a lot of chatter about it, and one thing I always like to do is try to find out what's hype and what's real, and this seemed like the perfect kind of issue to delve into and figure out, you know, there's clearly real stuff happening and interesting stuff happening, but there are also a lot of people overpromising things. So I thought I would spend some time and dig into these topics and find out what's true and what's, you know, maybe true.
Mm-hmm. And where do you start with something like that?
Well, I started actually by going into the scientific literature and reading a lot of the published papers about what's going on in this area, because there is some academic effort in this area, and so that was one place I went. I also went to look and understand what was going through the Food and Drug Administration, because the FDA ultimately needs to approve some of these algorithms before they become commercial entities. So I actually spent some time up at the FDA also, but also just sort of understanding what their pipeline looks like thus far. Unfortunately, people don't talk about things that are in the pipeline but not yet out, so I don't know what's actually in process at the FDA. But I do have a good sense of what they've already approved and what the parameters are, how they think about whether they need to approve things, and if so, how seriously they have to examine them before they approve them.
Right. And based on the two stories that have come out so far, it seems like a lot of the focus is kind of on, you know, artificial intelligence as a diagnostic tool. Is that kind of what you've seen in your reportage so far?
That's certainly the early focus of these efforts, because in fact, when you think about what computers can do really well, is they can recognize patterns, right? And so there are lots of things that are done routinely, like reading X-rays or reading mammograms or even reading pathology slides that people have to look at them and see if they can pick out patterns and recognize things. So that seems to be an obvious place where AI is highly likely to succeed. I think the next phase is likely to be helping people manage disease and sort of recognizing things like, take for example, the condition called sepsis, which is essentially the body's huge overreaction to an infection. It kills many people in this country. And one way to reduce the death toll from sepsis is to identify it early. People generally in the intensive care unit get sepsis. And so there are people who've been playing around with algorithms to try to understand, what do we know? You know, what are the early signs of sepsis? And can we pick them out and make sure that people actually are treated as quickly as possible with antibiotics and so on to reduce the risk that they will develop full-blown sepsis? So those kinds of, again, it's kind of a pattern recognition thing, but it bears more on identifying a broad sort of clinical patterns as opposed to sort of looking at an image per se. I think farther out there are people thinking, you know, gee, wouldn't it be great if you could have AI as sort of your guardian angel that's just keeping an eye, looking over your shoulder and seeing if doctors are making bad medical decisions. Because, you know, it's complicated to manage somebody's health, particularly if they have multiple conditions and they're taking a lot of drugs and so on. So one idea is AI wouldn't necessarily be deeply perceptive and, you know, and outthinking doctors. But what it could do is it could pick up errors and prevent errors from happening. So I think that's in the distant future, but I think that's also likely to emerge in the long run from this effort.
Hmm. The first story that's come out in this series deals with an algorithm that reads mammograms. What can you tell us about how doctors are working with that potential?
There are lots of people working on this because that's a very common procedure. And I think the hope is, at least in the short term, that these mammogram algorithms can actually look at a mammogram and say if it's a really completely clean one where there's essentially no question or very little question that there's a breast cancer in it, the algorithm can say essentially to a doctor, you don't even need to look at this one because it looks so good. I think then the next step would be everything else then would go to radiologists in the and they would take a closer look and apply their own skills to understanding and looking at those mammograms. And maybe eventually, I mean, some of these software packages are trying to develop up to the point where the actual entire reading is at least as good as the average radiologist, and maybe even as good as the best radiologist. But that's pretty far down the line as far as I can tell. Right now, people are just sort of shooting for average. It's an interesting issue when you think about it, because if you knew, if you don't really know who where your doctor fits into the general scheme of things, and very few people do, you don't know if your doctor is above average or below average. I mean, everyone wants to think their doctor is above average, but in fact, that's only true of half of all doctors, right, by definition. So if you're thinking about, this does as well as the average radiologist, on a population level, that makes a good deal of sense to say, okay, that's no worse than what we're doing now. But if you can figure out that your doctor is above average, maybe that's not as good an approach as still going to your doctor. And that actually raises one of the other issues that I explore further on in the series, is that the possibility that this will end up sort of splitting healthcare into the haves and the have-nots. As one person I talked to refers to it, we could end up sort of with a healthcare apartheid, where the poor people end up going to the kiosk to get their medical care, and rich people would continue to get, people who are fully insured and so on, may continue to go to their doctors and get the high level of care. So it really might end up splitting an already sort of precarious healthcare system and create a larger division of two classes of healthcare, which is certainly an outcome that we don't want, but one that I talk about in the story, because if we think about that sensibly going into it, maybe we can make sure that that's not the future that we end up at.
Right. Another piece that I thought was really interesting in that story is this idea of kind of the ethical and legal implications of something like this. If the computer gets it wrong and steps are taken in the wrong direction, who is kind of responsible for that? What have you found as far as developments on maybe the legal side of things?
Well, I didn't explore that issue very deeply, but absolutely, that's a major concern. That was one of the scientists who's developing this technology in Europe says that's sort of what's holding them back right now, is they have to solve those legal issues, and we need to solve them here in this country as well. But that's absolutely the case. It's the same sort of thing with self-driving cars, right? If a self-driving car causes an accident, who takes the blame? So we're thinking about this issue more generically in all of artificial intelligence, and I don't think that we have a solid, comfortable answer yet. But clearly, these are major issues that need to be resolved before these kinds of things really take off.
Right. And that same kind of comparison to self-driving cars brings me to we hear from a patient in this story. And what are you hearing from reactions of patients so far who are working with artificial intelligence and their kind of reaction to that move?
I think patients are okay with it. I think people trust computers. They know that computers are good at certain tasks, and in this case, it's the tasks they're being asked to perform. So I think patients are by and large comfortable with it. I think one issue that people have is concern about, for example, if you have an algorithm that predicts your likelihood of death down the line or your likelihood of getting breast cancer a few years hence, which is software that they are developing right now, then the question is, what happens if an insurance company gets hold of that information? Would I be excluded from getting life insurance, or would an insurance company jack up my rates or something like that? There are rules in place to prevent discrimination, but they're only so strong, and considering that our healthcare a system right now. The Affordable Care Act is under fire. So a lot of these protections come under the Affordable Care Act. If you get rid of the Affordable Care Act, maybe you get rid of some of these protections. So I think people are concerned about those kinds of issues more than, you know, whether or not they trust a computer to come up with an answer. And I think that's partly because we are accustomed to having devices and drugs and so on approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And I do have a story that looks more deeply at that and ask the question, you know, is the FDA, you know, how is the FDA approaching these issues? How are they taking care of these things? Because as long as we have a process that we can trust in terms of approval, we have experts looking over it before these things can go on the market, that gives us all a degree of comfort. Nobody says, well, you know, I'm not going to take this drug until I understand its mechanism of action. That just doesn't happen. It's like your doctor says, I trust it, and probably your doctor trusts it because she or he knows that it's approved by the FDA. So it's a so basically, it's we're building trust on the same kinds of systems that generally work for medical devices and drugs.
Moving to the second story that comes to these kind of so-called black box programs and teaching themselves to diagnose all kinds of different illnesses. And something I thought was really interesting in that story is this idea of kind of open transparency in the development. They're not working necessarily as like a private company trying to develop something under wraps. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about how doctors and computer scientists and researchers are kind of working together in developing these systems.
Yeah, well, I think it's all over the map right now because there's a huge amount of commercial interest in these areas. And I think a lot of this is happening under the cloak of proprietary information. And we really don't know how companies are doing what they're doing. And we don't even necessarily know what projects they're undertaking. But I focused on some scientists at Stanford University who are saying, you know, if we want this field to excel, we really need to sit down and say, okay, let's be open about what we're doing, share what we're doing, share our data, share our computer code, our software, and so on. So people can you know, kick the tires. They can look under the hood. They can understand really what's going on here. And I think they are not motivated by trying to develop a commercial product, although many times academics will end up finding a really good idea and then spinning off a company and doing that. So I think that's not a foregone conclusion that they will always operate completely in the open. But right now, given the state of development of this area, I think it's appropriate for a lot of the stuff to happen in the open. And that's really the role of academia when you think about it. We're largely funded by taxpayers. We as taxpayers and citizens are saying, look, we need answers to these big questions that are generic questions, not specific to a particular product. And the scientists get those grants and they are able to pursue these ideas for everyone's benefit. But as I say, eventually at some point, as things become more and more provocative as an actual commercial product, the likelihood grows that even academics will spin off companies and you know, close their doors a bit and start developing proprietary software as well. And that's happening to a certain degree, I'm sure, as well.
Mm-hmm. And that story also deals with kind of this idea of accuracy in diagnostics here and there. It's easy to see kind of both sides of the coin where on the one hand, you assume that, you know, it's a computer. It's going to be the most accurate in determining certain patterns versus needing that trained human eye to cite inconsistencies. How much of a focus is that throughout this series, this idea of accuracy when it comes to using computers in healthcare?
Yeah, well, obviously that's an important question because we want to know, you know, does the computer do it at least as well as the typical doctor? And you know, nobody gets things right 100% of the time. It's the nature not only of human beings, but of these medical tests. You end up getting false positives, or, you know, false alarms, and you also get the test saying you have a clean bill of health when you don't. So it's just part and parcel of the whole medical system. And so I think we as a society think a bit about, you know, how to find the right balance between false positives and false negatives, because you can end up, you know, if you have a test if you decide, I want this test to be, you know, to catch every single case, that almost guarantees that you're going to find many, many things that are false alarms. And if you say, okay, I don't want to have so many false alarms, then you know you're going to miss some results. So that's a generic issue in medical diagnosis that the computers have to deal with as well. But then on top of that, we also want to make sure that the computers aren't baking in human biases. For example, if they... if their sample set doesn't have a diverse enough pool of people of the right sex and gender and age and so on, you might get skewed results because the computers learn from one set of people, and then you're saying, okay, now apply that knowledge to another set of people, and that may in fact be false. That may not in fact work at all. So another major concern, I think, in the development of this field, that making sure that what gets developed can then be applied across those boundaries. And for example, the FDA, when they approved this piece of software that helps identify people at high risk for having diabetic retinopathy, which is a very common cause of blindness, the company that developed that software realized that it really had to test this in a whole bunch of different places. And they ended up testing it on 900 people in 10 different sites, everywhere from southern New Mexico with a heavy Hispanic population to places in inner cities and so on. And so they really worked hard to get a good cross-section. And it took them another year, basically, of research to make sure that they're to validate that their tests really would work across all of these groups of people. But I think that may have to happen a fair amount as particularly first of their kind new bits of software end up being introduced.
Mm-hmm. We've already talked about a lot of the challenges with introducing artificial intelligence in healthcare. What are some of maybe the biggest benefits that you're seeing and the big push behind this move?
Well, I think some of the big push is a lot of companies hoping they're going to make a lot of money on this. And so actually, I'm going to talk about another challenge before I talk about benefits, which is that people always say, oh, this is going to make healthcare cheaper because you can automate it. The doctor doesn't have to be in on all of these things, and you can have a computer do it, which should be cheaper. But I asked a lot of people, can you name one medical technology that ended up driving down the cost of medical care? And people do have a hard time doing that. New technology tends to drive up costs, not drive it down. So that's a hope that people, an aspiration people have for this software, or this whole world of artificial intelligence. And they can talk about, if you can really do the pre-diagnostic work well, you may be able to prevent, you may be able to avoid people taking CT scans, for example, for further diagnosis, and that could save money. But it remains to be seen whether these software packages really will end up saving money. That is one hope, clearly, of the effort. I also think it would be interesting if the software could reduce the number of misdiagnoses, because a lot of people get misdiagnosed the first time around. And to the extent that that's human error, maybe software can help reduce that. I mean, I'm sure there will be other causes of error that the software will introduce. But on the balance, if you get rid of more errors than you introduce, then you're ahead of the game. And so that could be very valuable as well. And, if you could have a better prognostic software that would look at somebody's, situation and say you're likely to have, you're at higher risk for developing, say, breast cancer in the next 5 or 10 years, that could guide women to take more mammograms and to be more watchful for breast cancer. On the other hand, that's another example of it possibly driving up costs. If people are being referred to more tests, you may not be coming ahead in that. So I talked to one of the last, I guess what will probably be the last story in the series. I talked to a prominent doctor at Stanford named Abraham Verghese, who says, what he would really like is to see is the software enter the most difficult realm of medicine, which is sort of putting together all of these assorted pieces to tell a whole story, to really understand a diagnosis. You and I may think in very simple terms about, you have a heart pain and you go in and you see, is it a heart attack or not? But a lot of medical diseases are much more complicated than that. People come in with a variety of symptoms. It may involve their personal history, their personal activities, a whole bunch of things that doctors sort of have to put together in order to really create a picture and understand what's going on. And really good diagnosticians can do that. But, you know, many doctors don't necessarily have the time to do that. Some are not as good as others. So Dr. Ferghizi is really hoping that what can happen is, in the long run, that artificial intelligence can dive deeply enough into a person's, you know, medical history, their medical records, you know, re-examine all of their lab results and x-rays and pathologies and whatever all else is involved, and really help propel forward that diagnosis and make it come clear earlier. And, you know, that's a distant dream, I would say, and I'm sure that Dr. Ferghizi would agree as well. But, you know, when looking, you know, aspirationally about what this technology might do for us, I think that's kind of the outer edge, the biggest hope at the end of the rainbow.
Mm-hmm. As you've worked on this series, I'm really interested in what are some of the things that have really surprised you?
What has most surprised me? I think just trying to understand the dimensions of it. I mean, one thing is I sort of went in thinking, well, it's already there. You know, we're already having artificial intelligence in doctors' offices. And there's actually very little of it that has actually made it in. But it's in some surprising places we don't necessarily think about. For example, there are complicated algorithms that help interpret an MRI, you know, the magnetic resonance image that you get if you go to a doctor and need a special MRI scan. We don't think about it, but it's really a complicated piece of software that takes all of the data that this huge magnet and all these other electromagnetic waves generate and interprets it and actually paints these pictures. And it obviously creates very sharp and very interpretable images. So in fact, AI has been around for a while and is baked into a few products, but it's not nearly as advanced as I think the expectation is, just given the amount of talk that we've heard about AI coming into medicine. I think the other thing that surprised me that I didn't know coming into this was to what degree people tried to do this back in the 1980s. There was an initial wave of this back in the 1980s, which fell on its face. And it turns out that it was just not ready for prime time. The data weren't good enough and so on. And I think that was, you know, this is not the first time computer scientists and doctors have gotten together and said, you know, let's see what we can do with these, you know, these two very challenging bits of technology and, you know, medical technology and computer technology, and seeing how we can make a marriage of them that will help. So I think that's a lesson and a reminder that things that seem great at the outset, you always have to wonder, you know, is it going to succeed? What are the unintended consequences? You can't just sort of, you know, kick it out of the nest like an eagle saying goodbye to its eaglet and saying, okay, you're on your own now. You really have to keep an eye on it and see how things develop, because that's really the beginning of the story, not the end of the story.
Right. This series will be ongoing over the next several weeks to kind of wrap up our conversation. Can you give us a taste of what the next installment is going to bring?
The next installment will look at some software that helps diagnose eye disease. I mentioned diabetic retinopathy, and I use that piece of software, which was approved by the FDA last year, as a way of looking at the FDA process of how the FDA thinks about these issues and how they develop enough confidence in a piece of software to say, okay, this can be put up for sale, and we're confident that that it will provide the results that we're looking for. So that's the next story up in the series, probably. I mean, things are not locked down exactly when they'll be on the air, but that's the next one we expect to be up. I have another story that has to do with Google, which is, of course, one of the biggest corporations on the planet, and they are interested in AI in healthcare in a very big way. And so I spent some time looking at what Google is doing and what it means for us, since Google gathers information about most of us, either from our Gmail or from our Chrome browsers or wherever. And so, you know, where will Google fit into this picture, both from the standpoint of consumers and the standpoint of other companies that say, you know, we want to carve ourselves a little bit of this space for ourselves, and knowing that this, you know, this enormous company is also interested in these issues must be a little bit daunting for some of the smaller companies that are trying to stake a claim in this territory. And then the last story really looks deeply at what this is going to mean for the relationship between people and doctors. And that's where I mentioned Dr. Verghese and one of his colleagues who was talking about this healthcare apartheid and asking the question, you know, how do we make sure that as this technology develops, it actually benefits us, not just the companies that are out to make money by selling these software and associated devices. So I think that's, in some ways, that's really the biggest question is, you know, is this going to benefit us as a whole, or is this just going to be another business opportunity that that we are sort of pawns in? So those are the big questions that I ask in that last story.
That was NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. You can find the first two installments of his series on artificial intelligence and healthcare on npr.org. Future stories will air on Morning Edition and All Things Considered.